Jeannie Patel Thompson, international best-selling author, health product formulator, horse listener, earth singer, mother, medicine woman, elephant acolyte, and regenerative farmer. This is the Jeannie Podcast.
Okay, this is something that a number of people have asked me to either write about or record a podcast on, and that is my father's medically assisted suicide. Of course, they don't call it suicide in the medical profession. They just call it death. And I've waited a while. He died about a year and 2 weeks ago. Because things like this are very packed with all kinds of emotions and family issues and all the rest of it. And I've also not been clear, because I had so many people ask me for this, I'm not sure what people want to hear. So that's the other reason I haven't done this for a while, because I'm like, what is it people want me to say, or what information are they missing? So I think what I'd like to start with talking about is simply the fact that I believe a good death is as important as a good birth. I think those are two milestones of human existence that if we can, you know, obviously do whatever we can, because especially with birth, you're so at the mercy of people around you and your structure and your, you know, whatever system you choose to be a part of, that especially for your first baby, it's very difficult to have that good birth. But that often sets you up for your, you know, second or maybe your third child to create better experiences for yourself, because you've experienced how terribly wrong things can go and you have a better idea of what you yourself need in that situation. So I think in that way, death is a lot like birth, that you just can't anticipate what that's going to be like until it happens. So in that way, you can have your idea, but the more that you can stay fully present in the moment, and really this is where your own personal practices of spirituality or grounding and connection are really going to come through, because if you are fluent at dropping into meditative state, if you are fluent with connecting and dropping into the body, both birth and death are going to go so 1,000% better for you. So, you know, for all of us, that would be the first thing. If you want to know how to have a better death and a better birth, work on your meditative grounding, connection, body communication practices. Because for my experience, you know, I've done yoga for 40 years, and I've done intensive meditation for almost 30 years. And in my world, the body is the densest part of the soul, and the body is the subconscious. So that connection to source, connection to your higher self, and connection to your body are very similar things. And all of that wisdom of the collective unconsciousness, the frequency bands of reality, all of that wisdom rests in your body. It's not in your brain. It's not in your monkey mind. Okay, so this is such a big topic. Let's start with the MAID procedure itself. So the official acronym for that is Medical Assistance in Dying, and it is legal in Canada and some parts of Europe. So my father, who is a doctor, he had extensive diabetes deterioration in his feet. They were basically rotting off his body. He had already had triple bypass about 20 years earlier, so extreme heart disease. There was no, he was 86 years old. He's been smoking for 60 years. Like, he's at the end. And he's someone who's been very comfortable. He's used a lot of natural protocols, which is how he lived so long with all those conditions. But he also has been very comfortable with drug usage his whole life, and he prescribes drugs for his patients. So this was a way of dying that was actually congruent with him. And I had spoken to him 10 years earlier, and I had said, you know, you really, can you not learn how to meditate? Because first of all, you're using your cigarettes as a stress release. Why don't you just use meditation? You can get the same exhale, the same down regulation of your nervous system, the same, you know, endorphin, like everything that you're getting from cigarettes, you could get from meditation. And he agreed, but did not pursue that. And then as we got closer to, you know, his health deteriorating more and more, and I raised it again with him, and I said, listen, if you learn how to meditate, you can release your soul from your body. You know, that's what astral travel is. You can do that consciously, but this time you release your soul and you just don't come back. Because if it's your time to die, you will be received by Source. You can return to God, Creator, Source, and you can do that consciously with intention and with the skill set that you've learned. And he agreed, but again, did not pursue that pathway. So I think that's important too, that with death, as in with birth, what you choose needs to be congruent with who you are for it to be a good experience. And this was. So my other brother is a medical doctor as well. And so he had, you know, quite a bit of expertise to bring to the scenario. But I'll tell you what was good about the MAID procedure in Canada. First of all, you have to go through two separate doctors who assess you and say, yeah, you really, you know, your condition is severe enough to warrant this procedure. And, you know, my mom, who, you know, they've been married over 60 years, she nursed my dad night and day. She summed it up in, as she looked at me and she said, you would not treat a dog like this. And what she was referring to was the fact that if there was a dog that was suffering to the degree and level and constant 24/7 that my father was suffering, you would put that dog down. There would be no discussion as to whether you would help that dog die. You 100% would do it. So that's another perspective on this, you know, like how, why is extensive, prolonged, intensive suffering okay for humans, but not for animals? There's a real incongruence there. So I think that's something that needs to be thought about and considered. So anyway, they do go through two doctors, and then once they have been, and the other thing you can do, because if you want to make sure that you will die at the last possible moment, you can get all your paperwork done in advance so that even if you are incapacitated, they can come and perform the procedure because you've already been approved, you've already given consent, you've signed off on it. What was interesting about my father is that the day that he scheduled the MAID event for, he was largely unconscious because he was not really breathing. So he would be lucid for about 30 seconds and he could talk very slowly and slurred, and then he'd just check out and his head would drop and he would stop breathing for like 60 seconds. And of course, the first time this happened, we were like, oh my God, he's dying. But no, this went on for days. He just, as his body is slowly shutting down. So that's the condition he'd been in. But then the morning of the procedure, he did what so many dying people do, which is came back to full consciousness, full lucidity. He was sitting up. He was joking with everybody, saying, well, I guess it's the final chapter. I guess it's the end of the road. The doctor was there trying to say, but do you choose this MAID procedure? Are you choosing to receive the drugs? And I don't know what languaging he used. I don't know if he was, maybe he said die, because he needed my father to say clearly yes. And my father just kept making jokes about, yeah, well, I guess we're at the end of the line. Nothing else can be done. And so finally my brother stepped in. He said, Dad, he needs to hear you say, yes, you're ready for MAID. So then my dad said the actual words. And then what they do is a nurse comes and she puts in two IV ports, which is, again, very wise because, as we know, veins can collapse. Sometimes things don't go well. You don't want to have someone half dying and then waiting there with what kind of suffering going on while you get another IV line going so you can finish the job. So they already have two put in, one in each arm. And then the nurse leaves and the doctor comes in. Then and the family is really in charge. So the doctor will work with the family to say, you know, how do you want, like if the family had some special requests about, you know, how that final injection of medication, which takes about 20 seconds, is done. They're very open to that. They're very respectful. So, and then he administers the drug and he stays until he ascertains that, you know, the person is dead, and then he leaves and they leave you to it. So, and then you've booked the funeral home to come in and pick up the dead body and remove it and then do cremation or whatever burial you've chosen to have done. And you have that scheduled ahead of time so that when you give them a call and you say yes, because right up until the final moment, so this is the other really good thing about the MAID procedure, right up until the final injection, you can say, no, I changed my mind. And the doctor tells you that. He said to my dad, you don't need to have this done. If you're not ready today, I can come back tomorrow. I can come back next week. There is no pressure on you to say today's the day, or and you are 100% allowed to change your mind, which I really loved about the way they've done this procedure. So if somebody does get down to the final wire and they freak out and they're like, no, actually, I'm not ready to die. I don't want to die. They can do that. And there's no penalty. There's no disapproval and there's no cost. There's no financial cost to saying, no, I changed my mind. And there's no punishment that, well, you can't book another procedure now for a certain amount of time because you changed your mind. There's none of that. It's like, you change your mind, this stops right now. You want to have it done tomorrow? We'll come back tomorrow. They're so well done and relaxed. Now, of course, this is going to be practitioner specific. So somebody else might get a jerk of a doctor and it doesn't go so well, or an noxious nurse and it doesn't go so well. We happen to have an excellent doctor and an excellent nurse who showed up for the actual procedure. So what we did as part of my father's good death is the night before he was scheduled for the injections, we held ceremony. And again, we just, I guess I led a lot of it. And I was just very connected to my dad's higher self. I connected to God, to source, to my own, just feeling for what wanted to happen and connecting into my mom, you know, because the death of a 60-year-old spouse is as much about the surviving spouse as it is about the one who's leaving. And so what ended up happening was I said, can we sing? And my mom and my siblings said, my mom was like, yes, because she's, you know, grown up singing in church and all the rest of it. So we just started singing. I started with Hallelujah because, you know, you don't need to know the same songs to sing to your loved one. And so, and then my mom wanted to move into Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, which all of us had known from our church days as well. So we sang a few, and then I had asked my mother and my one brother to assist with some energetic work because I was going to try and see if I could assist my father's soul to leave his body so that he could die that night, rather than having to go through the injection procedure, because there are some unknowns with those drugs. And I have written an extensive blog post about that and whether the drugs, whether you, you know, what's the mechanism of death? Is it, are you dying because your heart stops, or are you dying because you're actually drowning in your lung fluid? So you're waterboarding. And I had raised this with my dad as well. And I said, here's the concerns that no one knows because they haven't done enough autopsies. And my dad said, even if I'm dying from drowning, he said, a couple of minutes of agony compared to this, I'll take it. So, and interestingly, since then, I have had a conversation with another friend of mine who actually drowned twice. One when he was 7 years old, and another time when he was 17, he was upside down in his car in a lake and couldn't get out. And he clinically drowned and was in there for long enough. And he said, what happens? He said, the first two inhales of water are nasty, but then he said, this peace comes over you. He said, we were born in water. We actually are used to breathing underwater. And he said, it's like that returns to you. So I had always thought that drowning is about the most horrific death you could have. And he said, no, just the first two breaths. And then it moves into a beautiful space. So that's something also that's worth knowing. The other thing that was very interesting is I had one of my readers contact me after I wrote the first post about the MAID drugs. And she said, over a decade ago, when I was having ventricular fibrillations, I needed to go to the hospital to receive an injection of adenosine that would paralyze my heart for a second or so in the hope that the interruption to my heart's electrical impulses would then cause a reset back to normal beats. So she wrote to me about her experience of this. And she said, you know, the lack of full oxygenation to the blood that needs to circulate to the brain and body causes a great tiredness of all muscles and shortness, shallowness of breath. So she said, when the drug was administered, because this happened a number of times, she said, I always felt a huge heaviness around my lungs, like someone was putting a massive block of lead on my chest and was squeezing all of the air out of them. And I had a perception of blackness and a sinking feeling. My awareness was thinking, geez, I hope this goes all right and I'll soon be able to take a breath and I hope my heartbeat will return to normal. Consciousness is totally there. She would not lose her consciousness, her conscious thinking ability. She said, I would then feel the jolt of my heart and was always relieved when it regained normal beats. So that drug is very similar, and that experience is very similar to what we believe happens with the MAID drugs. So that's, again, just a couple interesting perspectives around the actual drugs used to kill people in this procedure. So anyway, we're back in the ceremony the night before he is scheduled for the MAID procedure. And I had asked my mom and one of my brothers to do some work with the prana, with the energy, bringing in white light, moving it around, while I tried to see if I could assist his soul to leave his body. And it was interesting because, and of course I had my father's permission to do this and my mother's permission. And it was interesting because my brother, who was working down at his feet, he said, I actually saw his spirit lift up about a foot out of his chest and then sink back in. And I said, yeah, I said, I couldn't get it to come. It's like he's holding on so tight, and that's been his default for so long, and it's congruent with his personality. He was not a relaxed, laid back, flexible person. He was a hold on tight kind of guy. So I said, well, that's okay. Like, we tried and we held ceremony and we sang and we tried to help him release his soul, and it didn't work. So he's going out the way he lived his life, you know, with the medical profession and with the drugs. So that morning, as I said, he became fully alert and he was joking, and he said a cognizant goodbye to each of us. And, you know, we each said our final words to him, and it was so beautiful. And just an interesting aside, my father has had issues feeling and expressing love his whole life. Very, very traumatic childhood. And this closed heart is throughout his whole family. And most of his brothers have had heart disease or died from heart attacks. So, you know, you can't have an emotionally closed heart and then think your heart, physical heart, is going to be okay. It's the two or one. But in this moment of him saying goodbye, he said, I love you. And I felt for the first time 100% open love flowing from his heart. So that's what I mean about a good death. Like, he couldn't do it his whole life. I'd felt it open to a certain degree, but this was all the way open, and his love flowed all the way. So that was super beautiful. And then we all stepped back, and we just were gathered around the bed, and the doctor did the injections. And when the doctor stepped up, we started singing. And like I said, we started with Hallelujah. And Hallelujah, you just sing whatever you want. Like, you just put whatever notes you want to it. It doesn't matter. Hallelujah, I love it because, you know, let's say you were toning or chanting, you think about those sounds, they're very much what you would have, you know, with Hindu toning or chanting or any kind of mantra. And you are invoking divine creator source. You are commissioning that frequency, that energy, that love, compassion, joy to stream into the room, to surround everyone there. And you are creating that pathway for his soul to travel back, to return to God, creator source. And so that was also the intention that I was holding, because, you know, it's very important when people die that they don't get stuck in this realm, and that they go, that they actually return to either their higher self or God, creator source, whichever is most appropriate for their soul's journey. If in doubt, return to God, creator source, because you get purified, you get unified, and then you can choose to incarnate or express however you wish after that. So that was the process and the space holding that we did. And it was, I did not know that you could sob violently and sing at the same time. But that's what we were all doing. We were all in that state. And as soon as he was declared dead, the doctor just left quietly, and we kept singing, and we sang until we felt it was complete and his soul had left not just the room, but left this plane and was on its journey home to God, creator source. I think the other thing that is super important when you have someone who is elderly and you want to do this before they start losing cognitive function is you want to have that conversation with them about how they want to be cared for and what they want their final months, weeks, and days to look like. And yeah, it takes courage to have that conversation, but it will save all of you, especially your loved one, so much suffering and so much humiliation if you have that conversation ahead of time, because your idea of a good death might not be their idea of a good death. Your idea of good care as the body and mind decline may not be your loved one's idea of good care. You cannot project that. Just like your idea of a good birth is the top obstetrician in a hospital, that's my idea of hell. That would be my idea of how to make sure I had the worst, most high-risk birth you could give me, because I don't feel safe in those environments. I don't feel comfortable. That is the last place I would want to give birth. So we cannot, and vice versa, right? A home birth in a water tub might be your idea of absolute high-risk hell. You cannot project your birth or your death onto someone else. That really has to be something determined by the person going through the transition. So in advance, it's really important to have that difficult conversation with your loved one and ask, what do you want your death to look like? And listen. And to say, okay, let's imagine that you can't walk anymore, so you're in a wheelchair. Someone has to lift you onto the toilet. Where are you? Are you at home with 24/7 caregivers? Because odds are, by the time your parents in that stage, there are very few people strong enough to lift a dead weight from a wheelchair to a toilet. So that's something that really needs to be taken into account. You also have to be really honest with yourself. Do you want to be providing 24/7 care to your loved one. And that's where I believe you have to be brutally honest with yourself and your loved one. Like when my dad was in decline and I was, my extended family was there and they were all, he's going to get better, he's going to heal. I was like, no, we're in the countdown now. And so I had those conversations with my father and I said, what are you going to do when you get like this? And he said, well, you're going to come and take care of me. And I said, Dad, first of all, I cannot possibly lift you. I said, you need someone way stronger and probably double my weight to be able to lift you because you'll be dead weight. And I said, and number two, I'm not doing that. I am not wiping bums and cleaning vomit. I did that for three children. I'm done. I said, I'll be here. I'll love you. I'll pay for your care, but I'm not going to be the one doing it. And like my Indian family were just shocked that I would say that, but that is my honest truth. And I will speak my truth because then that allows me to be there for my father in the way that only I can be there, which is in his final days. I worked intensively with his soul and we did a lot of the spiritual healing and the karmic healing that he, and I kept saying to him, what's holding you here? Because like he should have been dead and he's not. So what's not letting you leave? And he's like, I just want to die. I'm like, what's holding you here? What's preventing you? And he would give me an answer. He would give me a word and I'd be like, oh, okay, I see where you're. And I'd follow it. I'd go into meditative state and I'd go and find the thing, you know, and sometimes it was a generational energy or entity that needed to be cleared. Sometimes it was karma from another lifetime. So like it just completely varied. Well, there's nobody in my family that could have done that work with him other than me. And that's where I needed to focus. You know, I need to stick with my top talent, which is not wiping your butt and lifting you onto a toilet, wrecking my back, you know? So that's one thing. But again, to have that difficult conversation, because you might think, oh, my mom and dad, they want to be at home till the end. Well, them being at home till the end requires three full-time people because you can only work an 8-hour shift. So that's 8 times 3, 24 hours. So you have three full-time people. Do the math. Most people cannot afford that level of at-home care. It's $20,000 a month. So if you can and that's important to you, fine. If not, you've got to go into some kind of hospice, some kind of residential. And then that's, again, the really important conversation to have. Well, at what point do you want to go in there? And finding a place, can we customize the room? Can we hang his photos? Can we put bed linens? How much is mom allowed to be there? Because, you know, that's your next best thing. If it's like, no, mom has a bed in your room. She can sleep here with you. You've got your pictures on the walls. Everyone's allowed free access at any time. Like those are the things that have to be discovered. And I'm going to read you a little conversation from a writer called Rebecca Berry. She says, in the car on the way to dialysis, I asked my mother what she wanted her death to look like. That's a good question, she said. I haven't thought much about it. I told her about a death doula I met once on a trip to swim with dolphins in the wild. She had wonderful white hair and green eyes that the sea made greener, and one night at dinner, she asked everyone at the table how they would want to die if they could plan it. I thought this was the most marvelous question. I also thought everyone would have the same answer, to die quietly in their sleep. But no, that was not true. One woman wanted to die alone in a forest by a tree that loved her, no humans around for miles. Another wanted a violent, fast death, pow, lights out, possibly by gunshot. Someone else wanted to be with her horses. Another wanted to be surrounded by her children, the best drug she could get flooding her veins. What did you want? Mom said. I couldn't remember what I wanted then, so I told her what I wanted now. A death that was glorious and soaring, like autumn or Beethoven's Ninth, painless and exciting and so achingly beautiful that I remember that this whole thing is a gift and an adventure and ultimately a return to more love than we can even imagine. I'd like that too, Mom said, something like that. Do you want all of us around you singing? I said. That was what we did for my grandmother. Maybe not that much singing, Mom said. Then she told me what she did want. To be at home in her bed with everyone in the house, but not in the room with her. She wanted all of us in other rooms, doing what we wanted, being alive and together. That is exactly how she died. We had stopped singing or lying next to her, listening to cello music or whale songs, and were in various rooms doing things we liked. I was writing. My father was in the kitchen hanging things around. One sister was meditating, the other out with her dog. My nieces were drawing and playing cards. The whole house hummed gently with ordinary things, and Mom took her last breath. It was a lucky gift of a death, and I am still grateful for this. But I didn't remember that it was what she'd asked for until I found this conversation in my journal 2 years after she'd gone. When I did, 1,000 little white birds of peace flew from my heart. I'm hoping they find their way to yours. That's from Rebecca Berry. So that is just the most perfect example of someone having that difficult conversation with their loved one as they get to a point where you know they are going to be dying sooner rather than later, and to find out what they want and then help them to make it happen. So I hope my sharing this story has helped you get a little bit more clarity. And I really can't emphasize enough having those conversations about not just your death, but also your care. I read a whole book on this subject after my dad had passed. And it's just by a doctor who specializes in end-of-life care. And it's absolutely terrible, the situation that so many elderly wind up in, because no one took the time to ask them, what do you want for your final days? And sometimes the person refuses to talk about it. And then say to them, if you don't talk about this, you're going to get whatever you get, because I can't arrange for you what you want. And then if they say, oh, I just want to be in my home, okay, well, what is that going to look like, right? And like I said, is that even financially affordable? And if it's not, what are the other options? So my husband, going through this with his mother after his stepfather died, I said to him, because she was in a huge old stone house out in the countryside, there's no bus system, there's nothing, so terribly unsafe for her to be there, but she didn't want to leave the home. And I said to Ian, I said, you just got to take her out. Say, let's go for lunch and take her to the residential care homes that are around there and go with her and just say, we're going to go have lunch or we're going to go for tea. And then let her see them, because you cannot have a concept of something that you might enjoy if you've never seen it, touched it, tasted it, felt it. So that's a place to start. And yeah, you got to trick them sometimes. We're going for lunch, Mom. Well, they did go for lunch. So he wasn't lying. He just didn't say, we're going for lunch at a care facility so you can see how you feel about it, because he knew that's where her mental blocks were. So let's just go around those. And the place that he ended up taking her, it's absolutely stunning and beautiful grounds and so much to do. And he said, and so then the next thing he said is, listen, because you need to have some surgery now and they can give you really good after surgery care, why don't I book you in here for 2 weeks? And then after the 2 weeks, when you're, she was having cancer removed from her chest, when that is all healed, you can decide whether you want to continue on here for a while or move back and whatever. Well, that was all it took. After 2 weeks in that place, receiving, because she was only getting one meal a day dropped off outside her door. She was lonely. She had no one to talk to in the big old house. After 2 weeks of being in this place where they brought her afternoon tea and cookies and three meals a day, and her friends came by to play bridge, why would she want to leave? But he had to gently arrange for her to have that experience first and, ease her into it. And also he purposely chose a facility where she could be 100% independent, because she's, even though she's 91, she's on no medication and she can go for walks and hikes. She's in very good health. So she could have easily another 10 or 15 years before she needs actual assistance. And, you know, she may is someone who may maintain her mobility until very close to the day she dies. So the facility he chose was one where she could, if she lived the next 15, 20 years, stay in that one facility and not have to move again as she neared her final days. Because that, from the book I read, is what causes elderly the most distress. Like, that's why they say, I want to die at home, because that's where they know they feel comfortable, they feel safe, they belong. So if we're projecting out for that, and we know we can't afford at-home care for the final weeks or months, then we want to get them into a facility where they have time to make a home, and where the facility is good enough with, you know, again, we're talking ideals here, but they feel comfortable, and they create some kind of community and some kind of rituals and those feelings of home. And there's one more thing that I want to talk about, going back to the MAID experience, the medical assistance in death. And that is, for those of you who've ever been there with your dog or your cat, when you've put it to sleep, when you've medically assisted its death, this is actually a very similar thing. It's a very similar experience. You definitely feel like you are participating in killing this person. And now what's interesting is my brother, the doctor, felt like that. I felt like that. My mother didn't feel like that at all. She just felt pure relief and thank God he's not suffering anymore. So again, that's something that's going to be person specific. For myself, I have assisted in numerous animals' death. I've got dogs, horses, sheep. I've helped kill animals. I've slaughtered animals. Like, I am no stranger to death. And there has not been a single death that I've been a part of that I've felt easy and that I felt was no big deal, or they've all been terrible. And it was interesting too, because my brother, the doctor, when we were talking about it, and I was like, yeah, it was brutal. 'Cause like, you're helping to kill someone. Like, yeah, it's what he chose. And yes, just like an animal that's suffering, you want to, 'cause I've had to shoot dogs like that. You want that animal to leave this planet, because to stay here is heinous. But at the end of the day, you're helping to kill a live being. You're snuffing out its life force energy. And my brother said, you're a healer. You can't be around. You can't be a part of killing things. And I was like, that's a really good point. That's, again, we were talking about congruence, right? So even though with my dad's, death, I wanted and I needed to be there to support him 100%. I would not change that decision. I also have to understand that that's going to be a lot more difficult for me than perhaps for someone else. And, who knows? Who knows until it happens how you're going to feel about it and how difficult it's going to be for you? But this is part of life. You know, we do the hard things when you have any animal, whether it's a human or a dog or a snake, that is suffering, and you need to kill it. You need to kill it fast so it doesn't suffer anymore. And it's part of life. It's part of life here on this planet in third dimension. And so it may not be easy, and it takes some while to process it, to make your peace with it. For some people, maybe they would say, I don't want to be a part of that. I can't be in the room. And that's fine. Like, you do you. You do whatever your gut and your heart and your spirit leads you to do. So thank you for joining me for this episode. And I wish you all the best in your discussions with your aging loved ones. And just really, if you need help, get a book on the subject and it will guide you in how to have those conversations. And just start talking and sharing the love. Thank you.